Welcome to today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, May 15th. I'm your reader, Wanda, and here is our first story. U.S. retail sales plummeted 16% in April as virus froze economy. U.S. retail sales tumbled by a record 16.4% from March to April as business shutdowns caused by the coronavirus kept shoppers away, threatened stores across the country, and weighed down a sinking economy. The Commerce Department reported Friday on retail purchases showed a sector that has collapsed so quickly that sales over the past 12 months are down a crippling 21.6%. The sharpest drop from March to April were at clothiers, electronic stores, furniture stores, and restaurants. A long-standing migration of customers toward online purchases is accelerating, with that segment posting an 8.4 monthly gain. Measured year over year, online sales surged to 21.6%. For a real retail sector already reeling from the migration of consumers to online shopping and to app-based delivery services, a back-to-back freefall in spending poses a grave risk. Department stores like Neiman Marcus and J. Crew have filed for bankruptcy protection. Hotels, restaurants, and auto dealerships are in danger. An April analysis by a group of academic economists found that a one-month closure wiped out 31% of non-grocer retailers. A four-month closure could force 65% to close. The plunge in retail spending is a key reason why the U.S. economy is contracting. Purchases at retailers are a major component of overall consumer spending, which fuels about 70% of economic growth. Other than online, not a single retail category was spared in April. Auto dealers suffered a monthly drop of 13%. Furniture stores absorbed a 59% plunge. Electronic and appliance stores were down more than 60%. Retailers that sell building materials posted a drop more than 3%. After panic buying in March, grocery store sales fell 13%. Clothing store sales tumbled 79%, department stores 29%. Restaurants, some of which are already starting to close permanently, endured a nearly 30% decline despite shifting aggressively to takeout and delivery orders. With few Americans shopping, traveling, eating out, or otherwise spending normally, economists are projecting that the gross domestic product, the broadest gauge of economic activity, is shrinking in the April to June quarter at a roughly 40% annual rate. That would be the deepest quarterly drop on record. Spending tracked by Opportunity Insights suggests that consumer spending might have bottomed out around mid-April before beginning to tick up slightly, at least in the clothing and general merchandise categories. But spending on transportation, restaurants, hotels, arts, and entertainment remains severely depressed. Credit card purchases tracked by J.P. Morgan Chase found that spending on such necessities as groceries, fuel, phone service, and auto repair declined 20% on a year-over-year basis. By contrast, spending on non-essentials such as meals out, airfare, and personal services like salons and yoga classes plummeted by more than 50%. Contractors Moving Quickly on University Avenue Rebuild by Tim Jamison. Road contractors are moving quickly to complete the final phase of the University Avenue reconstruction project. Good weather and a traffic-free construction zone have allowed Peterson Contractors Incorporated to stay ahead of schedule on the $14.4 million contract to rebuild university near Ainsborough Avenue to U.S. Highway 63. While PCI has 2 years to finish the work, which started this spring, most of the heavy lifting could be done in 2020 if Mother Nature continues to cooperate. As long as the weather continues to hold out, they're targeting to get mainline paving done this year, Michelle Sweeney, project manager for AECOM engineering firm. That means everything from Highway 63 all the way over the Phase 1 limit near Ainsborough. Crews have removed the 6 lanes of crumbling pavement from Knoll Avenue to US 63 and we're dismantling an old railroad bridge that crosses over the Sergeant Hart Road Recreational Trail. They will be putting back 4 lanes of pavement, replacing the bridge with a box culvert, and building a trailhead and parking lot south of the culvert. Sweeney noted the project also lowers the grade of the roadway by 12 to 15 feet, with the excess dirt being spread on the former tree dump site. It's going to look substantially different, she said. When you're at Fletcher Avenue and you look at to 63, you used to see the old railroad bridge. That's all getting cut down, and you'll be able to see all the way to 63 now. Crews are also preparing to pave a roundabout at University and Fletcher, the only such intersection included on Waterloo's 3-mile stretch of University. That roundabout should open in about 2 months, which will allow PCI to pave the roadway to the west. The overall $3 million reconstruction of University Avenue in Waterloo was done in 3 phases, all by PCI. Work on the first phase between Ainsborough and Greenhill Road is essentially done. Contractors were finishing up median plantings and installing bus stop shelters this week. The second phase, from Greenhill West to the Cedar Falls city limits at Midway Drive, is in its second year of work. Crews are installing a water main under Greenhill Road now. That phase is expected to wrap up this fall. Some of the bridge monuments and enhancements on the Greenhill Road Bridge are part of the Phase 3 contract and may not be completed until 2021. But paving along the full length of University is expected to be completed this year. Waterloo is funding the bulk of the project with funds from the Iowa Department of Transportation. Water and sewer funds are covering work related to those utilities, and the Blackhawk County Gaming Association provided a grant to cover some of the more decorative features. Cedar Falls Arbor's development could add more duplexes than first planned in future phases, by Andrew Wind. A neighborhood in the southwest edge of the city could have more duplexes than originally planned under a proposal approved this week by the Planning and Zoning Commission. Midwest Development Company is seeking a preliminary plat amendment to add 39 more lots that would accommodate the 2-unit houses along the western and southern edge in future phases of the Arbor's subdivision. The 82-acre subdivision is north of West Viking Road, and the undeveloped portion is west of Arbor's Drive. The proposed change would increase the overall number of lots in the development from 204 to 243 once the future phases are complete. It would also increase the subdivision's average dwelling per acre from 2.48 to 2.96, which is still considered low-density residential. New street alignments are part of the proposal as well. Shane Graham, the city's economic development coordinator, told the commission that new configuration would mean 52 duplex units among 150 total lots in the development's future phases. The other 98 lots would be for single-family homes. What this does is it helps spell out where they are going to go, he said. Duplexes were already planned for the development and could have been built on any lots. creating two distinct properties divided by a zero lot line formalizes the ownership of the land under each duplex unit, noted Graham. Based on input from a prior commission meeting, the developer would need to meet a number of requirements, including at least two different house types with one and two story models. The price point they're looking at there is in the $250,000 to $280,000 price range, he said. Neighborhood resident Amy Rube expressed concerns about the change from what she believed would be all single-family homes. She also called for homeowner association rules that would not allow the duplexes to become rental units. I very much understand the concern of homeowners when they see duplexes, said Kevin Fitrow, representing Midwest Development and builder Skogman Homes. He added such restrictions would create a very hairy situation legally. We're developing and we're selling the homes, he noted. Like current homeowners, we do not want to see these up as investment properties. Commissioner Marty Holst suggested dividing the duplex lots in two would make it more likely each unit is individually purchased and remained owner-occupied rather than rented out. The commission unanimously approved the plot amendment. It must still be approved by the city council. The commission also set a public hearing for its May 27th meeting on a proposal to rezone 177 acres east of Union Road and north of West 27th Street for residential development. Developer Brent Dahlstrom and Echo Development would build single-unit detached homes on various lot sizes. The property is south of a planned new Aldea Lifescapes development and west of the planned new Cedar Falls High School. They can't dine together, but some Cedar Valley service clubs are still meeting online, by Andrew Wind. Gathering regularly to network and eat a meal together is a hallmark of service clubs. So when restrictions on groups were put in place due to the coronavirus pandemic, Cedar Valley clubs had to adapt. Some have managed to continue meeting with the help of video conferencing apps like Zoom. Coming together through the online venue has meant letting go of the meal aspect. And, of course, there are always some challenges when technology is introduced. Our average age is 62, said Lee Zeitz, one of the 38 members of the Kiwanis Rough Riders Club. But the University of Northern Iowa professor of instructional technology helped the Cedar Falls group get online starting with its April 15 morning meeting. He and a number of other members did a practice session in the afternoon before. That made it so the real thing went well, said Zeitz. After an extended hiatus from meeting, though, it wasn't only computer issues the members needed to talk about. The first couple of times, it was just connecting, he noted. We hadn't seen each other for over a month. Now, more than 20 Kiwanis members join the weekly online meeting, which sometimes includes a speaker. On Tuesday, the Rough Risers were going to take the next step, an online interclub meeting. They will join the Dobie Town Kiwanis Club in Kearney, Nebraska, via Zoom. The Cedar Falls Exchange Club first met online about a month ago, as well, said President Dennis Kehoe. He noticed that since most service clubs skew or older, his also includes those who wouldn't be adept at today's technology. Still, it's gone okay. It's like anything else. The more you use it, the more comfortable you get with it. Typically, the 28-member club sees 12 to 14 of its regular attendees at weekly noon hour online gatherings, a rate of about 75%. We still try to conduct the meeting in a similar fashion, said Kehoe, noting they start with a prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance. Basically, the only difference is there's probably more conversation on how you're feeling and what you're doing to cope at this time. The Waterloo Rotary Club is getting anywhere from 35 to 50 of its 60 to 65 regular participants at weekly online noon meetings. I've been pleasantly surprised. We had quite a few people join in, said Annie Vander Werf, the club's president-elect. It's been fun to see some still come together in a different way. The club's pianist has been able to play over Zoom as everyone joined in a patriotic song. Each week's program includes a speaker. And the technology isn't getting in the way of at least some of the older members participating. For example, a 94-year-old Rotarian joins the meeting every week. In the absence of having lunch together, Zoom's room application allows for smaller groupings of everyone involved in the video conference. At the beginning of our meetings, we're all put into different rooms so we can have that table conversation before the meeting starts, says Vander Werf. The club has also managed to adapt when it comes to another important aspect of service organizations, supporting community causes. Since part of membership dues cover the cost of weekly meals, the club's board decided to divide up those dollars and donate them to a series of community nonprofits. That's about $1,000 a week that, when we're not meeting, we're able to contribute, said Vander Werf. The other clubs won't be able to do some of their regular fundraisers at community events that have been canceled, but they're also finding ways to donate money or volunteer. Since this has happened, we've donated money to the food bank, and we kind of worked with Operation Threshold, said Kehoe, of the Cedar Falls Exchange Club efforts. We're still helping people out one way or another. The Kiwanis Club raises about half of its approximately $26,000 in annual donations for local organizations through kettle corn sales at festivals that won't be happening this year. So at its Wednesday meeting, members were looking at the possibility of fall events that would replace those. Both the Kiwanis and Exchange Clubs have established projects later in the year that they are planning on going forward with. Along with lunch money donations, the Waterloo Rotary Club received a $1,000 grant from its district for COVID-19 related donations. It contributed $500 each to the Mercy One and the Allen Hospital Foundations, both matched with another $500 of club funds. Overall, the group expects to donate $9,000 through the grant and lunch donations, noted Vander Werf. I guess us going virtual has been good for the community, she said. As Blackhawk County businesses prepare to reopen, officials urge caution, by Amy Rivers. Blackhawk County continues to slow the number of new infections Thursday. Officials reported 7 new coronavirus cases and 1 death for a total of 1,783 cases and 31 deaths. But Governor Kim Reynolds' decision to open restaurants, barbershops, gyms, and more Friday statewide had county officials warning those businesses need to strictly adhere to a cap of 50% of occupancy and make sure patrons are at least 6 feet apart, lest a second wave of infection overwhelms hospitals. Rules will be enforced with spot checks by everyone from the local police to state agencies, said Sheriff Tony Thompson. Penalties could include everything from a misdemeanor charge for offending business owners and patrons as to loss of liquor license. While that's not what we want to do, we do recognize that this is the governor's intent to have a measured approach to opening back up the state of Iowa, Thompson said. And that measured approach is for one very important reason, so that we don't jumpstart an economy at the detriment of beginning a secondary stage. Around 5% of county residents testing positive have required hospitalization, and 1.7% have died, according to Blackhawk COVID COVID-19.com. The county has an infection rate of 1.3% of its total population, sixth highest in the state. But some business owners, still unable to open due to state restrictions, are antsy to reopen. We recognize that there are businesses hanging on by a string right now, Thompson said. The importance for us is to try and help them to do the right thing in the right way. Several of the county's mayors noted they would reopen their city halls and other city facilities in some capacity in the coming days, some noting that they were looking forward to businesses reopening. It's your choice how you respond to this reopening. If you're not comfortable, you are not required to put yourself at risk, said Evansdale Mayor Troy Beatty. I believe that we are also a country of rights, and those that want to open and those that want those services should be able to engage in those activities. We all want to get back to life as normal, or as normal as now is possible, echoed Hudson Mayor George Wessels. We want to be able to enjoy a nice restaurant meal. We want to be able to attend our church. We want to be able to visit our friends other than through Zoom. But to do that and to keep it, officials said it was more important than ever to keep social distancing, wear a mask, and wash hands frequently, making sure employees are at newly opened businesses do the same. It's understanding that what you do has an impact, not just on you, but also to others around you, said Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart. We are just starting to make progress, so let's not test that progress because of pride or impatience. The county's website shows the virus has fallen disproportionately harder on non-white county residents, mirroring trends statewide. Only 51% of Black Hawk County's coronavirus cases are of white residents, though they're nearly 85% of the population. Black residents, while just 9.7% of the population, make up more than 27% of positive cases. Hispanic residents are 4.5% of the population, but 25.7% of positive cases. As Asian residents are 2.5% of the population, but 18.6% of cases. Most of the county cases, more than 48%, were among those 18 to 40 years of age. But more than 41% of the county's deaths have been among those older than 81, according to Nafisa Saiz-Ebiani, County Health Department Director. That age group is just 1.5% of all positive cases. Judge dismisses new trial motion in 2017, Floyd County slaying by Jeff Reinitz. A Waterloo man won't be getting a new trial for allegedly killing a Grundy Center man in 2017. District Judge Judge Greg Rosenblatt dismissed Armando Adame III's request to throw out a verdict finding him guilty of first-degree murder in the shotgun slaying of Michael Bruce Johns, 28. Authorities said Adame, 29, killed Johns in rural Floyd County following an October 2017 drug deal in Charles City, where the two received ibuprofen instead of meth. Johns remained missing for months before his body was found. A Floyd County jury found Adame guilty in a February trial, and he is currently awaiting sentencing. Adame's attorneys had asked Rosenblatt for a new trial, arguing the jury shouldn't have heard the account of a woman who said she saw Adame and Johns arguing. She also testified Adame had pointed a sawed-off shotgun at her head and said she could settle a debt Johns had with him, according to court records. In a ruling issued May 8th, Rosenblatt dismissed the defense request. The court also finds that the evidence is relevant to a legitimate, disputed factual issue in the case. This whole case involves the defendant's anger, mistrust, and impatience directed toward the victim, which was finally culminated in the murder, Rosenblatt wrote in his order. The defense also said the verdict was contrary to the weight of the evidence, but the judge noted evidence included Adame had told an acquaintance he shot Johns before Johns' remains were discovered, as well as an eyewitness who was at the scene of the shooting. Cell phone records showing locations were also part of the evidence. Adame is currently serving time for a federal firearms violation for the possessing the shotgun that killed Johns. He is also facing life without parole for the murder charge. Sentencing has been scheduled for June. Church helping with food distribution. The Apostolic Pentecostal Church in Waterloo will be doing emergency food distribution only during the remainder of the COVID-19 restrictions. Go to the church's Facebook page, http://www.facebook.com/APCWaterloo/. Click on the food pantry post, complete the form, and you will be contacted. If you do not have access, call the church at 319-234-2920. You are listening to the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Ronald M. Ehr, E-H-R, 89, of Lexington Place in Independence, formerly of Jessup, died of natural causes Wednesday, March 13, at the Buchanan County Health Center in Independence. Ronald was born May 23, 1930, at Jessup, son of Irvin Nicholas Ehr and Marie Dorothy Stable Ehr. He attended Jessup schools and later served in the U.S. Army during the Korean War. On September 1, 1953, he married Mary Jean Schmitz at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Gilbertville. Ronald farmed and was a pioneer seed corn dealer in Jessup for many years. He was a member of St. Athanasius Catholic Church, Knights of Columbus Council 8227, Pump Shear American Legion Post number 342, and served on the board of directors for Farmers State Bank, all in Jessup. He was a member of the Catholic Order of Foresters in Gilbertville. Survivors are his wife, a daughter, Patricia Balco, of Cottage Grove, Minnesota, a son, Michael, wife, Susan Ehr, of Jessup, 8 grandchildren, 18 great-grandchildren, a brother, Irvin, Jim, wife, Patricia Ehr, of Independence. 2 sisters, Mary, husband Richard Vogel of Independence, and Marlene Chowdar of Oro Valley, Arizona, and a sister-in-law, Janine Ehr of Jessup. Preceded in death by his parents and 2 brothers, Francis Ehr and Father Donald Ehr. There will be a private family funeral service at St. Athanasius Catholic Church in Jessup at 1 p.m. Saturday, May 16th. The service will be live streamed on the church website, www.saintaparish.com, in the church cemetery with military rites conducted by Pump Shear American Legion Post number 342 of Jessup. White Funeral Home, Jessup, is in charge of arraignments. Drive-through visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at the funeral home, 1315 Main Street, Jessup. Memorials to St. Athanasius Catholic School and St. Athanasius Catholic Church and Jessup. Online condolences at www.white-mthope.com. Beverly May Rapp, RAPP, 93, of Cedar Falls, died Wednesday, May 13th at Mercy One, Cedar Falls Medical Center. She was born May 18th, 1926, in Waterloo, daughter of George B. and Thora Stuland Leckington. She married S. John Rapp on May 18, 1947, in Cedar Falls. Beverly graduated from Waterloo West High School in 1944. She was a bookkeeper for her husband's service station business until 1990 and later operated Dry Run Creek Antiques. She was a member of First United Methodist Church in Cedar Falls. Survivors, her husband, a son, Stephen, wife, Dolly Meyer Rapp of Waterloo and Washington, D.C. A daughter, Julie, husband, Brian Lewis of Cedar Falls. Four grandchildren, Carrie, husband, Mark White, Eric, wife, Krista Lewis, Alexander Rapp, and Stephanie Rapp. Six great-grandchildren, Noah, Ethan, Zachary, Kennedy, Zoe, and Emmy. And a sister, Olive Kane of Bettendorf. She was preceded in death by a brother, Boyd Leckington. Private family services will be held Saturday at Richardson Funeral Service with burial in Fairview Cemetery, both in Cedar Falls. Memorials to the Cedar Falls Public Library. Online condolences at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Beverly loved reading, was a lifelong learner and talented artist. She enjoyed international travels, going to auctions, and researching history. She and John participated in antique shows around the country and spent winters in Melbourne Beach, Florida. A cherished wife, mother, grandmother, she will be missed by many. William B. Meister, 63, of Independence, died Monday, May 11th at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo. A private memorial service will be held at a later date. Reef Family Center, Funeral Home, and Crematory are assisting the family. Online condolences at www.wreathfamilycenter.com. Thomas A. Bacich, B-A-C-I-C-H, born October 1943, Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, passed away on May 8, 2020, at Mercy One, Waterloo. Thomas graduated from West High School, Waterloo. He married Sandra Warnke Dirks and raised his family in Waterloo. He worked 35 years in retail selling men's fine tailored apparel. He is survived by his wife Sandra, children Grant, Darren, and Sue, grandchildren and great-grandchildren. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Francis Clyde Claybaugh, C-L-A-B-O-U-G-H, 98, of Marion, and formerly of Parkersburg and Cedar Falls, died from complications of pneumonia Sunday, May 10th. He was born February 23rd, 1922, in rural Parkersburg, son of Clyde A. Emery E. Younger Claybaugh. He graduated from New Hartford High School. Francis enlisted in the U.S. Army Air Corps at age 19. On June 28, 1944, Francis married Dorothy North in New Hartford. While stationed in Liberal, Kansas, he was involved in a B-24 flight training crash. After Francis was honorably discharged in 1946, they returned to Parkersburg to farm his grandfather's farm. 14 years later, he joined his brother-in-law in a construction company venture in Cedar Falls. In 1966, Francis accepted a position with the Iowa Department of Transportation, moving to Marion. He retired in 1990 after 25 years as the bridge foreman over several counties. Francis was a member of St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion and the American Legion Post 660 in New Hartford. Survivors include four children, Donna, husband Brian Miller, Mary Nee, Steve, wife Sandy Claybaugh, and David, wife Marina Claybaugh, all of Marion. Seven grandchildren, Todd, wife Amy Hartke, Chad, wife Deanna Hartke, Andy, wife Amanda Nee, Eric Nee, Carrie, husband Eric Thorvig, Jesse, husband Brian Dengler, and Spencer Claybaugh. 11 great-grandchildren, Juliana, Dominic, Evelina, Gus, Sebastian, Adeline, Harrison, Holland, Maddie, Margot, Henry, and baby Dengler, due in August. A sister-in-law, Harriet Claybaugh, and 7 nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, wife Dorothy North Claybaugh, paternal grandparents, Wesley and Mary, husband Franklin Claybaugh, maternal grandparents Frank and Maud Parsons Yonker, 2 sisters Virginia and Mary Lou, 2 brothers Robert in infancy and Lauren Claybaugh, a son-in-law David Nee, and a dear friend Isabel Thomas. A private family funeral service will be held Saturday, May 16th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Graveside committal with military honors will follow at St. Patrick's Catholic Cemetery in Parkersburg. In lieu of flowers, memorials to Lynn Manor Care, 1140 Elam Drive, Marion, Iowa 52302. To the American Legion Post, number 660, attention, New Hartford Community Building in New Hartford, Iowa, 50660, or to the Disabled American Veterans at VARO, 566 Federal Building, 2010 Walnut Street in Des Moines, Iowa, 50309. Online condolences at www.murdochfuneralhome.com. The family wishes to express their gratitude to Lynn Manor Care and Dr. Thomas Richmond for the care given to Francis over the last 15 months, especially during the final hours of his life. Francis will be lovingly remembered for his good stories, sense of humor, integrity, love of birds and animals, hard work, love for his country, and for his family. Norma Zumack, Zummack, 95 of Reedland, died Sunday, May 10th at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo from a stroke. She was born November 6, 1924 in Reedland, daughter of Emil and Bertha Steidler Spear. She attended country school near Sumner. Norma married Lorenz Zumack on September 23, 1945, at St. John's Lutheran Church, Buck Creek, Sumner. He died August 11, 2001. Norma and Lorenz farmed dairy cattle, cows, hogs and chickens for many years in the Reedland and Sumner area. She was a member of Zion Lutheran Church in Reedland. Survivors of brother Laverne Spire of Sumner and nieces and nephews, great-nieces and nephews, and great-great-nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her parents, her husband Lorenz Zumack, a sister Dorothy Spire, who passed away at age 7, and sister-in-law Betty Spire. Funeral services will be limited to immediate family and will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, May 16th at Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Reedland. Burial at Zion Lutheran Cemetery in Reedland. Flowers, memorials, and cards may be sent to Kaiser Corson Funeral Home and will be given to the family. Online condolences at www.kaisercorson.com. She was blessed to celebrate her 95th birthday at Pizza Ranch with 40 friends and family present. She loved her little dog, Tiny, who will share her journey to heaven with her. She enjoyed playing cards, gardening, and spending time with her friends. Local and area sports briefs. Softball. University of Northern Iowa shortstop Sammy Bunch has been named the COSIDA First Team Academic All-District Honoree. Bunch carries a 3.63 GPA in movement and exercise science. Bunch has previously been named a first-team All-Missouri Valley Conference Scholar Athlete in 2019 and 2020, and was the 2019 MVC Player of the Year. Wrestling, several area athletes were named to the Predicament Academic All-State Team. Hudson State champion Ethan Fulcher was named the first team. Area athletes on the second team were Don Bosco sophomore Cade and Carson Tenold. Honorable mention picks were Osage's Ryan Adams, Denver's Jacob Moore, Decorah's Elijah Mitchell, Hampton Dumont, Carl Barkama, and Union's Adam Aronson. Iowa Speedway and NASCAR race weekends have officially been canceled as part of the revised NASCAR schedule. The NASCAR Xfinity Series races were originally scheduled for June 13th and August 1st, and the NASCAR Gander RV and Outdoors Truck Series race was slated for June 12th. The decision to realign the NASCAR Xfinity Series and NASCAR Gander RV Truck Series race events was on account of the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Iowa's first NXS race has been realigned to Homestead Miami Speedway as part of NASCAR's efforts to reschedule all points place races for all National Series events for the current season. Iowa's second NASCAR Xfinity Series race and the NASCAR Gander RV Outdoors Truck Series races will be realigned for a future date in the 2020 NASCAR Series. Area tourism professionals chose Waterloo Blackhawk Games in hockey as the area's outstanding attraction on Thursday night during the annual Cedar Valley Tourism Awards. For each of the past 16 years, experienced Waterloo and Cedar Falls Tourism and Visitors Bureaus have spotlighted businesses, organizations, and individuals in Waterloo, Cedar Falls, and surrounding communities who enhance and improve visitor experience. To Thursday's award ceremony was held online. We're also very proud and honored to receive this award because it is an affirmation of the Waterloo Blackhawks Valley value to our community, said Blackhawks President of Business Operations, Joe Green. I don't need to tell anyone that times are difficult for tourism and hospitality businesses, but bringing people to Young Arena and downtown Waterloo has a multiplier effect on our business community. The entire industry will have a role in revitalizing the local economy when COVID-19 concerns diminish, and we look forward to playing our part. Blackhawk Games have an estimated $2.4 million in estimated annual economic impact. University of Iowa's basketball head coach, Lisa Bluter, was named the 2020 recipient of the Girl Scouts of Eastern Iowa and Western Illinois Leader Award. It is an honor to be recognized by Girl Scouts, Bluter said. I believe in and teach their mission of building girls' character, courage, and confidence. The second annual award, the annual award goes to a member of the community that instills courage, confidence, and character into young women and girls. Coach Bluter is a lifetime Girl Scout and longtime Girl Scout supporter. NFL players accused of armed robbery at South Florida party. Police in South Florida are trying to find New York Giants cornerback DeAndre Baker and Seattle Seahawks cornerback Quinton Dunbar after multiple witnesses accused them of an armed robbery at a party, authorities said Thursday. Miramar police issued arrest warrants for both men Thursday on four counts each of armed robbery with a firearm. Baker faces an additional four counts of aggravated assault with a firearm. The residential community is located between Fort Lauderdale and Miami. Baker, 22, and Dunbar, 27, were attending a cookout at a Miramar home Wednesday night when a fight broke out, and Baker pulled out a handgun, the warrant said, Baker, Dunbar, and two other men began robbing other people at the party of thousands of dollars in cash, watches, and other valuables, witnesses told investigators. Police said the four men then fled the house in three vehicles, a Mercedes-Benz, a Lamborghini, and a BMW. Witnesses said the vehicles were parked in a way that would make it easy to leave quickly, leading detectives to believe the robbery was planned. No injuries were reported. Baker and Dunbar are both from Miami. Baker was one of three first-round draft picks the Giants had last season. He was the 30th pick overall out of Georgia. He played in all 16 games, starting 15. He had 61 tackles and no interceptions. He was the last of the three New York picks in the first round. We are aware of the situation. We have been in contact with Don Dray, the Giants said in a statement. We have no further comment at this time. Dunbar signed with the Washington Redskins as an undrafted free agent out of Florida in 2015 and was traded to the Seahawks in March. He started 11 games last season, making 37 tackles and 4 interceptions. We are aware of the situation involving Quentin Dunbar and still gathering information, the Seahawks said in a statement. We will defer all further comment to league investigators and local authorities. Dunbar spent Thursday morning on a video conference with the Seattle media for the first time since being traded from Washington to the Seahawks in March. You just want to feel wanted at the end of the day. I just hope to repay them with ways the way I carry myself as a person, Dunbar said on the video conference. Baseball in 100-degree heat? Contingency plan for playing in Arizona summer could be a hot mess. Arizona hung an open for business sign on its door this week, with pools, spas, gyms, and fitness centers opening Wednesday, and Governor Doug Ducey announcing that major league teams could start playing games in empty stadiums and arenas in the state on Saturday. Major League Baseball isn't ready to start up its season, but if the owners and players union can reach an agreement over salaries, teams could be allowed to begin abbreviated spring training camps in their home cities in mid-June. California has taken a more cautious approach than Arizona to opening an economy that was shut down by the coronavirus outbreak in March. Local officials have noted that COVID-19 cases and deaths in Los Angeles have not slowed. In Orange County, there has been a recent uptick. Barbara Farrar, public health director for Los Angeles County, said recently that the region's restrictions could remain in place well into the summer, and Governor Gavin Newsom declined to promise that the state's five big league teams would be permitted to play in their home stadium, saying, "We'll see where we will be in July." That could disrupt baseball's plan to open an 82-game season in early July, with teams playing in home parks, possibly forcing the Dodgers and Angels, as well as the San Francisco Giants, Oakland Athletics, and San Diego Padres to move their base of operation to their spring training sites in Phoenix. Asked whether Arizona might be the best home-away-from-home option for the Dodgers, Andrew Friedman, the team's president of baseball operations, said, "It feels like the easiest solution. Things are changing rapidly," he added, "and we're hoping that the positive momentum that has come from us being able to open up the trails and beaches continues, and we all collectively do our small part in keeping us on this upward trajectory, and that things look way better a month from now than they do today." One potential hurdle is that some players might balk at enduring Arizona's extreme heat. July is typically Arizona's hottest month, with daily highs averaging 106 degrees and lows around 83. Los Angeles area temperatures are at least 20 degrees cooler during that same period. The Arizona Diamondbacks, who would be in the same 10-team division as the Dodgers and Angels, would play in air-conditioned Chase Field in Phoenix. You would have to look at the time of day when we start. Obviously, it would be really early or really late to combat the temperature, Dodger manager Dave Roberts said. Arizona would have an advantage over Chase Field, but it's not just the Diamondbacks. It's the Rockies and every other team outside California. The dry weather in Arizona could also be a problem for pitchers who rely on humidity for better grip to the baseball and who often complain that their breaking pitches aren't as sharp in spring training games. The risk of injury, especially muscle strains, would increase in extreme heat. It would definitely be unusual, but I think there's going to be a lot of things about this season that are unusual, Friedman said. And as we've witnessed the last couple of months, with our kids or ourselves, our ability to adapt is really strong. I think it will provide just perspective to everyone that baseball in any form is way better than no baseball, and getting back to watching the best players in the world on the field competing will provide some sense of normalcy for everyone. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
This is Tom Hatton with an IRIS short take from the book entitled A Culinary History of Iowa. And this article, actually it says chapter 2, is entitled Immigrants Influence Iowa's Food Traditions. Hundreds of thousands of pioneers and immigrants from many parts of Europe and beyond flocked to Iowa in the 19th and early 20th centuries in search of a better life, whether that meant economic opportunity, religious freedom, or the chance to create a utopian society. These newcomers brought a variety of unique food traditions with them and transformed Iowa's culinary history. Some immigrants, like the French Icarians, were motivated by ideological ideals when they settled in America. The new state of Iowa, specifically Adams County, became the promised land for French men and women pursuing their dream to create a communal utopian society where everyone was equal. By some accounts, their Icaria colony in southwest Iowa was the longest existing non-religious, purely communal experiment in American history. The first Icarian party arrived in Iowa in 1852. They purchased about 3,000 acres of land from the United States government at $1.25 per acre to build their new colony near Corning. Living conditions in the untamed lands of southwest Iowa were often harsh. Log houses, some without wood floors or windows, were the French settlers' only shelter against the brutal winter. Most of the Icarians' land was unfenced, unbroken prairie, and there was not one settler along the trail before they reached Icaria, according to some reports. Supplies for the colony often had to be hauled overland for hundreds of miles. Only a few basic ingredients, including milk, butter, cornbread, and bacon, formed the daily menu. As a communal society, the Icarians worked together on the farms and ate together in a communal dining hall, where evening meals were sometimes followed by music or lectures spoken in French. Little by little, living conditions in the colony improved as the Icarians managed to establish a fairly successful agricultural enterprise. When wool prices skyrocketed with the outbreak of the Civil War, the Icarians thrived by selling wool and other supplies to the Union Army. While the war ended in 1865, trouble was brewing in the Icaria colony by the 1870s. Much of the conflict revolved around Little Gardens, according to an April 1921 article in the Iowa History Journal, The Pelham Pest. Earlier in the history of the Icarian community in Iowa, each family had been permitted to cultivate a little garden around their log house where flowers might be raised. Some families had planted vines and even fruit trees. Now that these plants were bearing fruit, the more radical members of the colony could not tolerate this violation of their rules against private property. The possessors of the gardens, however, clung to their little plots of ground. It wasn't much, but it was theirs. The authorities tried to settle the quarrel with a compromise. As each family moved from their log house to a new frame house, their little garden was to be given up. There would be no simple resolution to this dispute, however, which triggered open hostilities. The radicals claimed that the community had violated its constitution and announced their intent to withdraw. They also advocated an aggressive style of communism and appealed to a circuit court to revoke the charter granted to the community in 1860 on the grounds that Icaria was really a communist establishment instead of an agricultural society, as the Articles of Incorporation provided. By 1879, a group of younger progressive colony members had split from the older, more conservative members. This marked the beginning of the end for the Icarians' utopian experiment in Iowa. In 1898, members voted to end the colony. By then, it consisted mostly of elders who could no longer continue the hard work of operating the colony. The Icarian movement in America was over. The legacy of the Icarian movement endures, however. The French Icarian Colony Board of Trustees was formed in recent years and has been rebuilding the French Icarian village on a portion of original Icarian land east of Corning. The 1878 refectory, communal dining hall, and 1860 one-room Icaria school have been restored for tours and research. History comes to life at the French Icarian village through events like the annual Fête de Mai, Festival of Corn, which is held in the fall. The original Fête de Mai was a celebration held by the Icarians each fall after all the crops were harvested. The feast was served in the communal dining hall to everyone who came to help on the final day of corn harvest. In late September 2015, the Creston News Advertiser promoted the French Icarian village's fourth annual Fête de Mai, which included a four-course French supper featuring flavors of the Alsace region. It's a modern taste of the French Icarian's quest for utopia in Iowa. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Doherty Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.